Hello and welcome to Too Rash, Too Unadvised, Obstinate Squabbling on Seven Surrenders. My name is Liam Nolan.
And mine's Uwero Kaduki.
And I'm with a Martyr Complex.
And today we are discussing chapters 1, 2, and 3, in addition to the pre-chapter material. If you want to ask us any questions or be on the show, please feel free to reach out at toorash2unadvised@gmail.com. That's 2 as in the number 2. And again, I may check that email, so no spoilers, please. Also support us, and more importantly, our editor, on Patreon. With that out of the way, and many thanks to our Lord and Savior, Wes.
And Eternal Tyrant, who I'll, of course, kill.
Let's get on with the show.
Anyway, we have a new book.
We do.
Also, I'm a guest on the show.
Also, you're a guest on the show. Welcome back.
Before we start on the new show and the new book, obviously we greatly value those of you who turned in score sheets. And to let all of you who haven't turned in score sheets know that you have another week to turn them in. So next week we'll be announcing the winner of the Ethics Bowl competition. Competition's tight, so send in submissions.
Okay, is it though?
You're
phrasing that as though there isn't a very clear winner already based on the submissions that have come in. And it's interesting to me that you're doing that.
If we double submissions, it's very clear that things could change a lot.
That's true. If we double the submissions plus one, the winner might change. If you haven't gone through the Ethics Wall episode yet, it genuinely will be more fun if you are sitting there being judgy at people and marking down their failures. I promise it's a better experience. But I think most people will ignore me and not do that anyway. It's now my goal for this podcast to get to the end of the book so I can make you all do Ethics Wall with me again. So Seven Surrenders is a title of the book that we're reading.
It begins...
I don't know if it's the only title. I haven't checked.
It's the only one on the cover of the book.
So let's start with the pre-chapter stuff, because I actually have a bunch of notes from there. Because it opens with a cast, which is very fun.
First it opens with a permissions page, again.
Yes.
And mostly not in my different version.
What? Oh, because you read the preview. God, you missed a lot.
I didn't. I read the Kindle preview, not the end of the last book. I read the Kindle downloaded sample thing.
Did it not have a thing before that? Like, at all?
It has, the author and publisher have provided this ebook to you without digital rights management software, DRM, applied. Which I think probably isn't in... in canon.
So it doesn't start on permissions page.
No, it I'm pretty sure. Oh, no, I'm wrong.
Okay.
It does.
Did you read that?
I did. I read all of it. I just had them in the wrong order in my notes.
Okay.
Seven Surrenders being a continuation of Two Like the Lightning, a narrative of events of the year 2454. Most of this looks the same, except we get a quote from Apollo Mojave, which is very mysterious. It reads, "I won't be certain who the killer is until..." Actually, I shouldn't read through it that excited. This is a very dour quote. and I've definitely taken the wrong tone with that one. It reads, "I won't be certain who the killer is until I meet them. But if it is Mycroft, be merciful. Keep them alive and safe and working. You need them. If you have lost me, you need them. There are things I have undone that only Mycroft Canner can complete." And here's the thing. That doesn't, strictly speaking, invalidate my Emperor can't kill anymore theory. But it does put some strain on it. I'm also sure it wasn't in the first book. Like, 60%.
That was not in the book.
It was not in the first book.
There's also a couple of other interesting things that weren't in the first book. For example... the Latin phrase, Qui veritatem desiderit ipse hoc legat nihil obstat nihil obstet.
Yeah, the
originally
nihil
only had nihil obstat,
yeah.
And they added nihil obstet.
Yes.
Now, we would explain that, but the first chapter does that for us.
I can add another thing. It has a subjunctive. I did not mean to say that in such a satisfied voice.
Additionally, the Gordian Exposure Committee content ratings are different. Specifically, S3 has been upgraded to S4. The only difference there is that it does not just have references to rape, it has rape listed. And R5 is different because it has added theological abuse, theological assault, and recent incidents of global religious controversy. None of those were in the first book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Didn't they all, or did I just skip over it? I thought global trauma was also.
Global trauma was in the first book.
Yeah,
it was
in the
first
book.
Second book.
Okay.
Global trauma was.
Yeah, it's been a while since I read this page of the first book.
It's true, but you did just release the episode of you talking about it, and now I can correct you on something that you mentioned.
Oh God, what did we do?
Wait, we released that?
And the consent
that?
Of all.
Yes, I told you that.
Oh, okay.
That was the filler episode that you put in to make everyone suspicious as to whether or not there would be a sequel podcast.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I stand by that, by the way. You all had it coming.
Did we have it coming, or did the publisher of this book have it coming?
Two people can have things coming.
So...
So
the phrase and with the consent of all free and unfree living persons herein portrayed, Liam was asking, how do you get the consent of all of society? Because he suspected that the book might talk about society. By the way, the book does talk about society. Good job, Liam.
I think that was kind of a gimme, to be honest.
The trick here is that the word persons is the one used, which is individuals, as opposed to people. Which would be collected. So every named character, or I guess in the case of the servicers, the unnamed characters, who is still alive and in a position to give their consent, consented to the publication of this book.
We have more kinds of people than just like living people.
Yes.
But it's
like,
only with
it
the
turns
consent
out Apollo
of the
Muhammad
free
did not
or
consent.
Unfree living persons. So the dead did not consent. That's fine.
That's true. I was going to say corporations.
Wait, corporations are people in this series? That's
they're
fascinating.
They're legally people in ours, in our world. And historically there have
been
more kinds
of... They're legally groups of people, which is a... They're not legally persons.
No, that's not true. They're legally...
Like in the same way that a union is people.
You're sure that they're legally people and don't legally have the rights afforded to people?
No, they are, in the US, corporations form a person, not a natural person, but a person, and as such have, like, various rights, including, like, free speech rights.
Interesting.
This all mostly gets to the 2012 presidential election, which is not something we need to rehash right now.
I know, I'm not trying to, like, rehash a political thing, it's just, who's even dealing with the series far in the future? There might be more kinds of people than we're expecting.
True.
Even if,
so if there
right
are potentially
now,
people who are neither
for example,
free nor
plastic
unfree,
army men
would be unfree. Military people aren't free, right? They're bound to service, if I understand the military.
Well, this was not a world with a military.
But they're military men.
The soldiers, you mean. Okay.
Yeah.
In any case... the servicers aren't free.
And the servicers are the unfree people we discussed,
Or like
and then we move on to a deeply helpful page... that should have been in the first book. Cast list. It explains who everyone is.
A dramatis persona, specifically.
I have some notes from this, actually. There were some real surprises as I scrolled through this cast list. So let me take them in what looks like the order I got them. Pointer, not making an appearance in this book. I really expected him to. Even weirder, Croucher is not listed as one of the Major's men... but just as some malcontent.
He's listed the same way that Aimer is listed, so he's still one of the Major's men, but he's separate from the Lieutenant, and he's separate from the rest of the group undifferentiated.
I think he is specifically intended to be set apart more. The Major is listed as a veteran, then we get an indent for the rest of the army people. But yes. Aimer is listed as his lieutenant. Looker, Crawler, Medic, Standers, No Gun and No Standard listed as his men. And Croucher is merely listed as a malcontent, not the Major's malcontent. So I think there's going to be some problems there.
Mm-hmm.
And then Saladin is similarly given the indent to Mycroft Canner, which puts him in sort of that same, as I read it, subservient role, which I wasn't expecting. I had pictured Saladin as being perhaps the more active of the two, but we get some Mycroft stuff in these chapters that I'm quite pleased with, so perhaps that was a misread. What else do I have on this? Sniper, listed as a living doll. That feels intentional. And Tully, listed as a warmonger. That's also unexpected. I thought Tully was arguing against war. Maybe I literally read his lines incorrectly. It would not be the first time that has happened.
I'll raise this question. If someone is saying war is inevitable, get ready for it, mm-hmm. is that a statement against war or promoting people towards war?
I don't think it's really either. I think for me to think that warmonger was justified, Tully would need to be actively promoting a war. He would need to be going out and trying to cause one to happen. Just saying that one is inevitable, even causing one by making the claim that it's inevitable, but without doing it intentionally and with purpose. I don't like the term for that. So I think Tully might be a little more pro-war than we thought, which is one of the reasons I'm not 100% on Mycroft's side after the first chapter. Second chapter.
Alternatively, there are two additional things that are worth noting. Sure. Is Tully exposing Mycroft, the fact that he's alive and the fact that he's working for the most important people of the world, is that an act of warmongering?
That was not intentional.
I think no. Yeah. It goes back to his intents and his purposes.
The Cannabeat trap happened after Tully found them. Like, it's one thing if Tully, like, hunted Mycroft down. Mycroft just, like, happened upon Tully.
Happened, you say?
Tully seems surprised.
Tully also seemed surrounded by a bunch of people who had beef with Mycroft and were ready to spring. Yeah.
Like, a Mycroft trap. My point is that that action doesn't make him a warmonger. That just makes him some guy trying to kill Mycroft. That's fine. Different.
Not just kill Mycroft, to expose that Mycroft is connected to all the most important people of the world.
Someone probably should, frankly. I think he has a valid point. All the most important people in the world.
Sure, but a warmonger could be doing it for the right reasons.
But a warmonger would be doing it for the reason of starting a war. That's the whole thing I'm getting at here. It speaks to his intention in a way that I do not think is justified by his actions. Or at least not so far.
The third point I will mention is that this dramatis personae is written by Mycroft.
Yeah.
So Mycroft's opinion is that Tully is a warmonger. Or at least he's going to say that.
Is this written by Mycroft?
There is ample evidence in the text here that it is written by Mycroft. Or at the very least, someone who shares Mycroft's opinion on several important factors, such as, here's an interesting note, J.E.D.D. Mason and all of his subordinates... is listed as a tribune, capitalized.
Mm-hmm.
His mother, the divine
Eve. Yeah. You've got me there. That does seem very Mycrofty.
Yep.
Also putting Martin Gilbreaker under Jed Mason as opposed to under Mason. And putting Jed Mason as an independent force instead of...
We know that Martin Gilbreaker specifically works for Jed Mason.
Yes, but he's also like a recognized familiar. He's also like a familiaris.
I don't know. I think it's
a judgment.
Yeah.
Like, he works for Jed Mason, but Mason could kill him. That's a confusing sentence. He works for Jed, but Cornell could kill him.
Sure. Another thing I want to point out that I don't know quite what to make of is that Occam is listed as officer of security, while Leslie is listed as a security officer. And that feels like something important.
You say you don't know what to make of it.
You don't know what to make of it.
You don't know what to make of
Officer
Occam Sinir
of security.
O, capitalized, followed by but, S, capitalized.
But we know it isn't true.
What isn't true?
Didn't Sniper say later on that Occam wasn't OS? I specifically have a note that says, oh, Occam
okay.
isn't OS,
I'm
what
gonna,
the hell?
We're going to get slightly ahead of things. Occam is noted as being the 12th OS. Sniper lists themselves, or himself, as the 13th OS. What that means, we don't know.
Okay. In that case, I'm a lot less confused about what's going
okay.
on. I was very confused by that. But you raise a... If that is true of this text, then that's a fair point. I'm back on board for what's going on there. Sure. Okay.
It's also interesting. We're getting the full names of everybody in the Sinir Weekspoon Fosh, and we see Occam Sinir is OS. He's not the only person with OS in his name,
mm-hmm.
which I
no. This is
find
clear, but we knew that. This apparently goes
yeah.
back to like World War I, so that's not very surprising.
The ideology goes back to World War I.
Theology references World War I as a founding piece.
Yeah, but I mean, I'll give it to them. This clearly isn't a thing that's just started recently. I'm fairly confident that if we got the full names of the family's generation. That not the the parents' generation, there would be at least one that matches the pattern.
Mm-hmm.
Or am I? Now that I say that out loud, perhaps they are the...
I mean, we did get that discussion with Papa and Martin about them killing their family in a whitewater rafting incident.
Yeah, and I was on board for that. Is there a reason they would do that other than the assassinations, though? Because it sounds like the assassination plot is basically this OS thing.
You say, other than the assassinations, though. What do you mean by that?
So, is it plausible? I'm trying to remember a book that I read too long ago now. So, it's not necessarily the case that even if... Oh, boy. I apologize, audience. I've been talking to the side of the microphone for a little too long there. It's possible that even if the parents' generation was involved in the OS program... when at the time it was substantially scaled down, because we know they've been accelerating, certainly, that they may have still been doing the OS stuff, and that they were killed by the children for some other reason, not to hide the fact that the children were going to start doing assassinations, as Martin assumed, right? Martin wasn't actually there. It's possible they had some, I don't know, ideological conflict, or perhaps the children killed the parents as one of their OS targets, right? That's not out of the question. We haven't gotten good details on this. The book has just strongly implied things to us.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's correct.
I think the family probably has been involved in this program, if you will, for a while. The Emperor, I get the sense, is older than they are, so I bet he probably worked with their parents. I don't know why they killed the parents. I don't have a great theory for that. There's a lot of politics going on, and we maybe shouldn't have taken 3 weeks off, because you were right.
Really?
It throws you way directly back into the thick of a lot.
Yeah, I have opinions on this fact. You will note in a lot of sequels to various books, there's a lot of care taken in the early chapters to reintroduce characters and concepts and go back over the things that we've learned already and while still trying to move the plot forward and establish new characters and things like that. It's a very delicate art. This book does that only to very limited extent. I'm not sure the degree to which that's a stylistic choice versus, you know, the author decided not to for other reasons, but it's mostly not happening here. The dramatis personae is probably the best way for reintroducing a lot of the major concepts.
You were told, Anonymous has been talking to us, so you were saying that it was that the author had to split the book in two.
Yeah.
Yep, that is my understanding as well. But it turns out I can still hold someone responsible, even if they were, you know, presumably then my issue was with the publisher and not the author, but it's...
Yeah, well, our anonymous would be happier if we didn't hold anyone responsible and just blamed the nature of reality. But as I've said to them more than once, in person and over email, that's just not how we operate at Too Rash, Too Unadvised. If it's not the author's fault, it's the publisher's. And frankly, if it's not them, the publisher's, I'm going to go ahead and blame both. This should not have been two books.
It's also possible that it was the right call to split it into two books, but that right call is still lamentable. Or right, any number of other positions. Like, in a perfect world, it wouldn't be like this. But it turns out no one blew up this world to make a perfect one, so we're going to have to deal.
The last thing I want to get into here, before we move on, while we're still discussing the humanists, is that Thisbe also has O and S in her name. And there's a reference later to how she's terrifying to everyone. So I'm going to go ahead and guess that she was probably already OS at one point and was the best at them at doing it because she's a witch and that would really help with assassinations.
It's interesting that she's not listed as a witch here. You kind of think if Mycroft was writing it, he would have put that as her job.
But he promised he would stop.
Yeah.
That's true. She's listed as a smell track artist, which is a really weird thing. Like, not a caretaker of Bridger, but she's listed among the Sinir Weeksbooth group as a smell track artist, and she's listed first. It's a little unusual.
These all are a little unusual. Madame de Chouray.
There's a lot in these first three chapters that's a little unusual with Thisbe. At one point, Sniper says, "I'm as objective here as Mycroft is about Thisbe," and that really stuck out to me, because I don't remember Mycroft talking that much about Thisbe, except for the witch stuff.
A witch!
But she might be. Is that what he meant? He was describing how pretty he thought someone was. I don't remember a lot of Mycroft Thisbe fawning, but
There was the witch stuff.
Yeah.
Which I think might have been objective, if I'm being honest. So I don't want to say it was that. I mean, this is a world with Bridger. There's no reason we can just rule out the idea that Thisbe is an actual witch.
That's very reasonable. It's one of the questions. Another interesting thing that I like here, Casimir Perry and Isabel Carlos II are listed as if they are equals and as if that one is not really subordinate to the other, which is interesting considering Casimir Perry is the current prime minister and therefore Isabel Carlos II should be underneath him, but that's not how Mycroft sees it, which is interesting. Also, Papa's listed as a detective, not as, you know, head of the police, which is
cute. I think
cute.
What Papa is a detective more than anything else, obviously.
Yep.
Like, that's true of him as a person more than his job title would be. He has a Mycroft table from his one great case. Come on.
That he still uses from 14 years ago and is equivalent to his everything else desk.
Yes. He is... Also, we get Apollo Mojave in memoriam, which I didn't expect to see. Because, like, that implies that Apollo may be the only currently dead person who appears in this story, and that would be weird.
Interesting. I will also note that one character listed here hasn't actually shown up yet.
More than one hasn't shown up
yet. More than one.
Which one are you talking about?
Mushi Mojave. I don't believe has even been mentioned.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I believe you that they haven't shown up.
Yep. A lot of characters haven't appeared on screen, like Darcy Sock, Lorelei Cook. But Mushi's the only one I don't believe who's even been mentioned.
Have we seen Cat and Robin?
We have seen all the Mitsubishi kids.
Those are the twins.
They have been mentioned. They've been mentioned, but not... I think one of them might have appeared on screen.
We don't know which, because we never know which.
It's a whole thing. We'll get into it.
Interesting. I didn't remember them in that case. And that gets us through... Oh, and then at the end we get the quote that To Like the Lightning came from, and that you all now know the name of this podcast is a reference to Not Too Fast, Too Furious. Thank God we had that recorded, because no one was ever going to believe me.
I believed you. Notably, it does not include the lines "too rash" or "too unadvised" about.
It's before. It's unfortunate. Before that.
Yes.
It's there, we promise.
The text, by the way, is too like the lightning which doth cease to be, ere one can say it lightens, meaning that it's something gone before you can even describe what its effects were. Mm-hmm.
And then we hit chapter one, where we find out some stuff about Jed. Apparently we're going to get a lot of Jed in this book, and it's going to make him look really bad, and he allowed it to be published anyway, because people wanted to know stuff. Good for him. Jed comes across very well in this opening batch of chapters.
Really?
Does it?
That's how you take chapter two?
What, that Sniper wants to kill him? I'm pretty much fine with everything I actually heard, yeah. Like, oh, the person who murders people wants to murder another person? Come on. If, I don't know, if, who's someone I wouldn't expect to want to do a quick little murder on the side in this story?
Mycroft.
If Papadelius said, don't worry, I'll kill Jed for you, then I'm gonna maybe turn around on it, right? But it's Sniper. His name is Sniper. We just found out he's from the murder family. No. Sniper wanting to kill Jed Mason does not change my opinion of Jed Mason at all.
But yes, we get what is basically an extended riff from, I presume, Mycroft, about how J.D.D. Mason is going around making sure he gets permission for the publication of this book, and how Mycroft is asking God, the actual God, to make sure that the book is allowed to be released as well. Which is interesting. It's certainly asking things of God is a common thing that people do, but it is a very curious act in certain ways. It has a certain air of presumption to it, but
prayer to
take a side note here. The act of prayer is an act of presumption.
That's one interpretation, yes.
Okay, but like, if most people who care about God pray to God. That's not how they interpret the act of prayer.
Well, hear me out. I think you need to think back to how Mycroft has presented sort of his model of divinity before, right? We know that Mycroft's God is the author, and because of what we know about writing, like, I think you can read this as an actual textual request to the publisher. The literal publisher.
Tor Books, please, please don't leave it on a cliffhanger.
We know...
I have so much more!
There is only one power absent from our permissions page which could still stop us. We know who that is. It's the publisher.
So his God is the author.
I'm very on board for this. I don't
there
even think
few...
it's that much of a stretch.
It's certainly an interpretation. But
if there is benevolence
in more...
you, capital U, Strange Creator, Nihil Obstet is what you think Parma wrote to the publisher of this work.
Yes.
Okay.
Do you
there's
not?
There's flattery, and then there's this. In that interpretation.
Look, I wouldn't say this if it wasn't for the fact that Mycroft had been so clear about what his, like, model of God looks like. It's very explicitly the author.
I don't agree with that interpretation.
Well, then I'm sorry to break it to you, but I read that paragraph, and I'm correct. So...
What makes you think that Mycroft, like, just this paragraph? Or other things?
No, in Too Rash, Too Unadvised, we have a chapter where Mycroft breaks into Providence
into
and how
like
he
the
thinks
lightning.
It works. Into Like the Lightning, yes. And he was really clear about it, as far as I'm concerned, that his model of Providence is the author of the work that he exists within, so Dr. Ada Palmer.
He gave,
five models. That's the part I don't agree with.
In that section. One of them just literally pulled the whimsy of Poople Adams.
No, see, I don't think that's true at all. I think he was giving examples. I think in context, it was clear to me that those were all examples of how someone might write a story. And how
the whimsy
one might...
of Poople Adams is how someone might write a story.
Yes.
How
do you go about having solved a problem? Yeah.
As an example, like, there are authors who roll die to figure out who dies in a given chapter. Like, there is a prominent web serial that has used that.
Yeah, I just read about that worm.
But the way I interpret it as...
Oh, was that how they wrote worm? I didn't know that.
There is a specific section of worm that follows that.
What part are you going to do? We've talked about this before.
Chapter 8, Extinction.
So, spoilers for Worm, everyone, it turns out. I've tried to read Worm 3 times, and every time I get to shortly after the main character, whose name I'm blanking on, becomes a...
Taylor.
Thank you, Taylor becomes a good guy and runs around with them for a bit, and then there's a time break. And then that team of bad guys shows up again, and I've never made it through that. It's painful
hang on,
to me.
You keep starting and making it like 80% of the way through the book.
Yeah, and because the first 80%, it's pretty good. Stuff goes on, the status quo changes, and then I get to that arc, and I have dropped it 3 times in a row.
You can just skip that arc, you know.
That's not how reading works. I'm told it ends.
It does.
It does end. It also has a sequel.
It also ends pretty soon after. The point you're talking about.
I didn't know that
like
I was
you're talking
close.
About.
You're very
you're talking
close.
About like chapter 26, and it goes up to the 30 plus an epilogue.
You're very close.
That's yeah. disappointing to hear. Maybe I'll have to start it again.
Welcome back to Too Many Bugs in Too Many Places. The occasionally thoughtful read-through of Wild Bow's Worm.
I think there was already one of those.
If what Mycroft is saying, when he talks about, you know, the author of the great scroll in all of history, what he's talking about is a god who is somewhat deterministic, which can be a literal author of a literal text, but can also just mean an interpretation of actual divinity in a universe where... free will either does not exist or free will has already come to determined conclusions that can be predicted from a given state of the world, at least if you have an omniscient idea of it. There are views of free will that are compatible with determinism. And I think it's more that Mycroft is suggesting if God is playing a hand in this, if God has a will, then... it has a variety of ways of doing that. And there's a lot of relevance to the question of authorship, but it's not strictly literal, it's also metaphorical.
Yeah, I think the metaphor is a fake-out, and it's completely literal. And as much as I hate to move away from such a fantastic argument, because really this is a solid one where you can't just go and Google something and then declare that I'm wrong, you'd be forced to convince me. I've just checked the time, and we have 3 chapters to get through.
Yeah.
Next thing we get is we hit a chapter that Sniper narrates.
Yes.
And it opens with a restriction saying that this section has to be cut from the document before it can be published. It's restricted by a number of people, and I gotta say, it made me very nervous, because all of the things they were claiming happened in it, for example, the Conclave of Sensayers of the Universal Free Alliance restricts based on the reason of libelous attribution of criminal acts to a licensed sensayer. I gotta tell you,
who licensed sensayers?
If you didn't think that the stuff Julia and Dominic were getting up to in the last book was libelous attribution of criminal acts, what in the Christ is about to happen in this chapter that you decided the restrictions needed to happen now? It turns out very little.
Very little? That's... what?
Yeah, I expected a lot worse. They did a little bit of kidnapping. They didn't even kill anyone. I mean...
They kidnapped and drugged a member of the most security-focused bash on the planet.
Not even for the first time, though.
No, this is the first time.
This is the first time.
He's already kidnapped people from that house.
Who? What?
No.
Tiny people, but people.
Oh.
He's been wandering around in there for days. No one cared.
they did care a lot when they found out.
All right, they cared a little bit, but like nobody restricted the information is what I mean.
Sure, but people, I think, are not expected to believe that Dominic has actually kidnapped a bunch of tiny army men.
Whereas Sniper is a real person, whose fans get apparently very intense about them and are willing to riot outside newspapers when they're about to reveal Sniper's gender.
Biological sex.
And if you kidnap Sniper, who knows what they're going to do now?
I don't think they're going to do much at all, actually.
Because they don't know?
No, I just don't think that they... I don't think that many of the characters in this book are prone to doing stuff about kidnapping. I just feel like everyone's weirdly cool with it a lot of the time.
Why?
I'm very suspicious of this opinion. Like, black laws are okay with black laws getting kidnapped and killed, but that doesn't mean that everybody's okay with murder.
Well, black laws are pretty okay with murder.
Sure. But everybody else isn't a black law. Black laws are supposed to be a relatively small sliver of the population.
Do we know how small the sliver of the population is?
In the next chapter, they describe how hiveless is unappealing and there are not many hiveless.
Less than 1%. Yeah, we get stats about how many hiveless there are.
Okay.
It's less than 1%, and the black laws are all hiveless?
No, hiveless are 1%. Black laws are all hiveless, so that has to be less than or equal to 1%.
Yeah, because okay. There's also white laws and gray laws.
Yeah.
Other fun things we get in this is finally some background on Mycroft and the motives for his murders. And you know what? It's fine. It's not about how he was sad because his family died. And I... Fantastic. Thank God. Mycroft wasn't just sad about his family dying. Spectacular work. I don't think he had a very good point, but I'm on board. Good job, Mycroft.
So, to be clear, this chapter is somewhat unique because it is not narrated by Mycroft. It is like one of our Martin chapters, except instead of being written by our you know, hero detective guy, we are instead having it being written by Sniper sometime after the events of this story, at some point when some shit has definitely gone down, but we're very unclear on what it is. But Sniper is now a fugitive somehow, which is...
And doing well.
And doing well, and recovered from their injuries.
Although, in addition, we don't actually know that we know that there might be a chance that parts of this chapter are not, in fact, written by Sniper. One of the reasons for restriction is that Papadelius thinks that substantial parts of this document have been altered or forged.
So, at some point in the future, Sniper and possibly additional people have written this chapter, which describes how Sniper is kidnapped by a person who is very definitely, but is not explicitly called, Dominic, to be given to a person who is very obviously, but not explicitly called, Julia, for the purposes of fulfilling the agreement between Dominic and Julia, so that in exchange, Julia will give Dominic Carla.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In the course of this, Julia... a drugged Sniper who is incapable of movement or speech is taken essentially as a doll, including a sex doll, by Julia, and talked to extensively, has all of their secrets revealed that can be revealed just by looking at someone.
Actually, I'm going to jump in real quick. One of the things we get from Sniper when he's put in, because they like... Dominic does him up as one of the dolls that are bought in the store. So he puts him in the box and everything.
Puts him in a box. Yep.
Sniper's first thought is apparently, I must just be a doll that's come to life. So he checks a notch he had carved into one of his teeth. And I'm 1,000% sure that's going to become relevant to the plot later. And I want to get that in now. There's no way that doesn't come back as a deeply important piece of this story. So when Bridger inevitably makes a Sniper alive in itself, it will know.
Sniper also notes that they didn't know about Bridger's power when they got the indent, but just thought it'd be a good idea for that exact eventuality somehow.
Well, he seems to have a lot wrapped up in dolls, which I actually have some questions about how they made him so perfect for his role that he, like,
I have a lot of thoughts on
that. His greatest desire is to be a doll. It's really convenient that happened to the doll baby, right? So, I don't know if that's a thing the Brillis might be able to do. I don't think it's suggested that he's a set-set, although that's what I turn to immediately as a solution to developmental problems in the world of Terra Ignata.
The way Sniper says it is that apparently it was easier to become a world-renowned athlete and superstar than to compete with Arkham to become leader. Which gives you some information about how intense the competition for leader is. Or makes you wonder...
It's possible
a world-famous celebrity
that Sniper is just very attractive.
They do talk about how that, you know, child that was the original basis for the original Sniper doll was, like, the prettiest child anybody ever did see, with all the most beautiful generic characteristics.
Yeah.
So, I think you've got something going there. Also, just to finish up the summary, among all of these things, Sniper also talks about, gives us a full description of Mycroft and more information about them, talks about what their job is, which is described as an assassin, and gives a lot of justification and reason for it, and then promises to kill Jehovah Mason, using that term, not J-E-D-D or any of the other names for that character, for you, person reading this.
Yeah, so people might end up having some problems. But I imagine once this is published, people are going to, you know, Jed Mason will have done some things people didn't like, which, frankly, I think he probably will have a pretty good point or a decent reason for doing them. But that's mostly because Sniper isn't really selling himself to me here as being really good at deciding who's right about stuff.
That's fair. He does talk about Mycroft as being the first person he falls in love with, outside of his bash.
But the reason for that love is because Mycroft is talking about human freedom as the motivation for his crimes, that if what actually matters is the choices that we are able to make in a state of true freedom, then we should naturally be able to choose to do the wrong thing, to do evil, to do the ultimate evil. And therefore, because we have access to that choice, the decision not to be evil still has purpose and meaning, as opposed to, you know, we never ate the fruit in the Garden of Eden, so we are incapable of doing anything wrong, and that's just fine. And that is why Sniper finds that compelling, and Sniper's reason for, you know, saying, I'm gonna go kill Jehovah, is similarly, in some important way, to preserve human freedom, to care about the difference that people's choices constitute.
Well, I want to... I want to make a distinction between finding someone's point compelling and falling in love with them because of their act. I think the analogy you're making is very important and good, right? Between the justification Mycroft gives for his crimes and the assassination Sniper promises us. And that would set up something like an intellectual thing between them, or an emotional connection. But, like, Sniper blows past all of those things and says, I fall in love with that person who has just murdered his family and ate them raw. Which is something more.
Hey, we know he cooked at least one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, actually, so there's a distinction in, like, Homeric Greek about how you eat someone. If you have cooked flesh, that suggests that you are in communion with humanity, and if you are eating raw flesh, like a lion would, that basically says that you're a beast and are not being assessed as a human being, that you're somehow reduced to an animal state. So whether Mycroft is eating raw flesh is very definitely important.
Sounds like both.
I think it's both.
Which is
You're going to make a distinction. You talk about the Greek words for love. No, you're going to have Greek words for eating.
It's. I don't believe they're actually different words, but eating something raw is often like lion compared to, like, that's something that happens with Achilles in the Iliad. He's described as, like, promising people, I will kill you and eat your flesh. And that is supposed to represent that he's not doing something acceptable with the bounds of human society. He has gone outside what humanity would consider appropriate and normal.
That's
true. Or even, like, acceptable, even in extremis.
That's true. He does do that a lot in that book.
Anyway.
Now, I do think... I'm disappointed with Mycroft's... Don't get me wrong. I was really worried Mycroft was going to turn out to be a murderer for, like, utilitarian reasons or something. And this is better than that. But it sounds like he was, in a sense, trying to make people happier through his murders. Like, he wanted to give them, it sounds like, the ability to be proud that they're not evil like him because he has gone out and done this terrible thing for no reason. And I think that's just... I hope we get some more detail here that clears up the whole problem where he does have a reason that he's doing it. And ultimately, it is a little bit in the service of the world to demonstrate how far we've come along. I think it describes him as having been motivated.
He's making a moral point. I don't know that it's necessarily a utilitarian, I'm going to make people happy point, but it's a point about humanity.
Yeah.
And the state of society.
I don't necessarily think Sniper knows... I don't think Sniper is a good source for what Mycroft was trying to communicate here, because I don't think Sniper is a great source for a lot of things. So I'll be unsurprised.
At least the way that I read it, Sniper is talking about, like, Mycroft's public statements and whatnot, and that implies that at least that is the story that Mycroft was giving the world.
Hmm.
So I think that speaks to more than just Sniper judging it. Like, that maybe. In the same way that, you know, when Mycroft talks about a public speech, we can assume the public speech is more or less accurate.
He said they were tapes, but annoyingly, we know that there's more to this we don't understand, because just this chapter we got a quote from Apollo about how there's some extra thing that Mycroft is needed for, etc., etc. So clearly we don't have the whole story here. I really would like to just get the story about what's going on with Mycroft. I hope that this will not insist on being a mystery until the end of the series. I'll be frustrated if I have to keep wondering about it through four books of doing this podcast.
Here's a question for you. Do human beings have simple motives for their actions? Like even a single philosophical, consistent reason for doing something?
Single motivations?
Yeah.
I suppose it depends on the action.
So, let me give another example here. You're doing the most important thing you will ever do in your life, something that you know is going to reverberate throughout history, something that you're going to think on years before you do it. Do you think, at every step of the way, when you've had thoughts about it at different ages, at different points in your life, in different moods, wondering whether you should go through with it and resolving to do so and then doing it, that you only have exactly one reason for what you did?
Sometimes you have a really good reason.
So, we're on a subject of assassins. So let's talk about perhaps history's most famous assassin, Brutus. A lot of people have a lot of opinions about why Brutus...
Which Brutus?
Yeah, I'm clarifying. The Brutus who killed Julius Caesar.
Okay. Quick, remind me. Am I pro-Caesar or anti-Caesar on this podcast?
You were pro-Caesar. I was
pro-Brutus. Caesar? Okay.
I think I described myself as a Brutus kin in the text
bastard.
Below the episode.
So does Brutus... You know, there have been 100 different takes on what Brutus was doing. He made a lot of speeches on the subject of why he did what he did. And a lot of psychoanalyzing as to whether his reasons were legitimate or whether he was justifying his actions when really he had some more personal motivation, or whether he was jealous, or whether he was doing a just tyrannicide, or any of those sorts of things. Do you think Brutus only had one reason for what he did? You can't talk to Brutus, we can't ask him any questions, but given all of the different supposed reasons he might have done something, did he only have one reason for doing it?
I don't think he did. Mycroft might.
He is a fictional character, and that's different, and importantly different.
Yep, he may have had one really good reason. It's very possible.
Okay. Do you think that the whole, like, he has a dead family and it makes him maybe somewhat crazy, invalidates that? Or is it irrelevant, or does it make that possible? What's the relationship between?
The relationship to Mycroft's family is that I have read too many, and I think I've talked about this on the podcast before, I've read too many books where they create a monster and then attempt to humanize the monster and make them sympathetic and give them relatable, understandable motives for things. And I am tired of it. If you want to make a character be a murderer, I don't need to hear about how their mom was mean to them. Just make your character be a murderer, and let's move on to something more interesting than family drama. I'm worried that Mycroft is, in this book, going to be humanized in that way, where we have taken a character who has done terrible things, and now they're going to try to justify those terrible things and make them feel like they were for good reasons and understandable reasons. And frankly, I would really appreciate it if I could read a book where the author just said, this character did a murder on a bunch of people, and murder is bad, and now we're going to move on, and murder is still bad. And that's strangely hard to find. I don't know why it's kind of fallen out of vogue, but it's annoying to me personally.
On the subject of murder being bad, if I can redirect to a somewhat different question.
Sure.
Sniper talks about the role of an assassin,
mm-hmm.
And the importance that it plays in history, and how when a tyrant springs up, you need someone ready to commit tyrannicide and in a position to actually do so, in order to maintain the world in a good state in some capacity or another. It's worth noting that in a lot of the ancient world, and especially ancient Rome in the days of the Republic, tyrannicide was frequently justified and often completely legal. But then the question of who is a tyrant became the relevant question. For example, after Caesar's assassination, there was a lot of discussion in the Senate on whether or not to declare Caesar a tyrant so that his murder would be justified. And the reason they didn't is that if Caesar had in fact been declared a tyrant, all of his legal actions would have been declared invalid, and a lot of the people who were in a position to make the decision as to whether or not he was a tyrant would therefore have lost their appointments and lost all of the protections of their appointments and been able to be thrown to the mob that loved Caesar and wanted them dead. So, the question of was Caesar a tyrant was not just an ideological question, but it became a political question with weird political answers that ended up being like this unsatisfying, half-assed, oh, it was okay to kill him, but all of his stuff before then was totally fine. So here we've got Sniper making an argument in favor of killing tyrants. A, is it actually a good thing to kill tyrants to preserve freedom or to prevent the dissolution of the things that matter to us? And B, do we have any reason to believe that the person that they're promising to kill is in fact a tyrant? And C, what the hell does that have to do with killing losers who don't have any importance on world history to prevent things from getting worse?
Well, I do think they're doing a good job preventing things from getting worse. Clearly their system worked, right?
I think they have there's two different arguments going on. There's an argument in the beginning, and then towards the end, where Smart was like, here is why you should have assassins, here is why you should have tyrannicides. And then at the very end, there's a bit about the purpose of individuals in history and why it would be effective and why it would be good for humanity to select individuals to live or die based on their effect on world history.
Yeah, I agree. I do think that they're unrelated points. There's one other thing I want to point at in this chapter, though, which is that they gave Sniper 5,000 words. That's odd.
And they blew past that amount as well.
Why didn't they give him more words? Surely we have the storage in the future to hold text files. I don't know what they were in such a rush for.
People won't read, like, I don't know, another novel instead of this novel.
That's all about how we should totally kill that one guy.
I feel like people would read that. For sure people would read that. People love getting a good rage
on. Have you read the Unabomber Manifesto?
No.
That's what I thought.
Is it good?
That's actually an extremely difficult question to answer. It is generally regarded as one of the most internally consistent pieces of philosophical writing ever put to pen, but Ooh. That doesn't necessarily make it good.
That does sound interesting, though. I wonder if I could get a copy of that without getting on a list.
Yes. It is trivially easy to get a copy of.
That doesn't mean you can't get a copy
That's
of it.
That's not what I said.
I am in several Discord servers where people will post Ted Kaczynski's face in response to things that make them sad about the modern world.
Oh my god.
It's a weird place, man.
And Prims, yo.
Yeah. He also claims he's not an Amprim, because people have written to him in prison and he has said, I'm not an Amprim, you're a bunch of idiots.
Oh, that's very
despite his
fun.
Work being like a foundational work in anarcho-primitivism.
I'm pretty sure he might be an Amprim. I'm gonna have to read it, I guess. I haven't read any Amprim stuff, because...
It sounds dumb.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We briefly touched on the sniper wanting to be a doll thing. I don't think I have anything else. Oh, it turns out he is, he has the equipment from both genders, and they're not sure if that was surgery. Here's my pitch. There's no way it was surgery, because Sniper was built by his father, who was obsessed with building dolls.
You think Sniper's a doll?
I don't think Sniper is a real boy.
Okay.
And not just for those reasons.
So Sniper is some kind of, like, cloned experimental thing in your estimation?
Yeah, I don't know how much of this is doll construction and how much of this is the gene editing that we've already seen, like, Danae and her brother undergo.
Ganymede.
But there's no
it's
way...
It's not just that. It's also the case, we have it said when Papa is introduced, that gene editing is done on everybody to make sure, at the very least, that they age slowly.
Yeah, so there's...
So it's common in the society.
There is no way that Sniper is, Sniper was created. They tried to throw in this thing about his bash father, or just parent, I forget which one, being obsessed with creating dolls, and then he creates the doll baby that everyone wants? No, I don't buy that. This was on purpose.
Sorry, obsessed with creating dolls, is that in the previous book?
Nope, yeah. It's in this chapter.
I mean, it also happened in the previous book. In the Sniper's chapter, Minecraft talks about how...
Well, Mycroft doesn't say anything.
Not this chapter. In last book,
okay.
In Sniper's chapter. Called Sniper, I think. Not
Enter Sniper.
Yeah. Talks about Sniper's bash father, who worked at a doll company. And they needed a model, and they just picked one of his kid.
They just took the kid, yeah. That's true. I forgot that part. So I actually have
designing
a lot of thoughts
dolls
on this chapter.
Is described as his Bapa's all important but secondary task.
Mm-hmm.
Like Thisbe
Much
doing
like,
smell tracks.
Thisbe doing smell tracks for movies, yeah.
Yeah.
I actually have a lot of thoughts on this chapter. I have a lot of thoughts on Sniper as a character, some of which I can't get into right now, but some of which I can. Do you think Sniper makes sense as a human being? Like, all the stuff that happens to them in this chapter and the stuff that they describe, like, presumably not all of it's 100% true, but, you know, most of it is it approximately something that a human being could think.
I don't really think he's a human being. But also, yeah. Kinda.
I try not to give lots of bounds on what human beings can think. I found that, like, people can think a suddenly large amount of things and feel a suddenly large amount of ways.
That's very true. There are a couple of ways that people think about Terra Ignota, and one of them is that there's a lot of plot, and then there'll be a brief chapter that is basically just delving into the weird psychology of one fictional character. And this is probably the most explicit that gets, though there are other examples. And Sniper's psychology, to me, has a lot wrapped up like a doll, in... what matters is other people. And I can try and explain this. I might not do the best job putting it into words.
We're losing every like third word.
Oh, I'm very sorry.
Oh, I can hear you.
Hopefully this will all be clear on Audacity. Sniper cares about being a doll, cares about making themselves into the perfect version of that. Whether that means surgery on genitals or surgery on the top half of their body to remove breast tissue, or training in a thing that lets them be the most things to the most people, and having a public persona of being in all sorts of different outfits, so that anyone out there who wants can have a version of them, and at the same time has an intense sense of duty and at least some sense of familial obligation towards this whole Senir Weeksbooth-Bosch assassination conspiracy thing. That the important thing that they've been raised with in this house full of murderers that involved them competing for the job of top murderer was some sense of duty to the world and to the rest of humanity. And I wonder if that influenced them at a very deep level to want to basically say that duty is not just what is asked of you, but what is what the world specifically asks of you. And in this case, that's, you know, killing people to prevent the world from falling out of control. And in Sniper's case, additionally, to be the most desirable thing so that they can give themselves to other people.
Not the world, just the hives.
The trouble is, that kind of creates a little paradox. If you want to be all things to all people, you actually can't. At some point, you have your own will. You can't be everything to everyone. You have to make decisions about who to prioritize, what ways you should be. And because you are in a position to make those decisions, you can never fully let go and be only for others. And what happens in this chapter is that someone gives that to Sniper, and Sniper adores it, supposedly. I don't want to mince words, because I feel like we've minced some words about this. Sniper is drugged, paralyzed by the drug, kidnapped, and then someone has sex with a thing that is not in a position to consent. And the book did tell us at the beginning that this book was going to contain rape. I'm going to call it what it is. I'm going to say that Sniper is raped.
Mm-hmm.
And is basically saying, yep, that's an addictive, wonderful thing that has now influenced my psychology extremely deeply to the extent that I'm kind of down for it in the future. Now, were you trying to interrupt me with some, like, incisive comments? Because I was going on for a while there.
No, I didn't have much on that. That all feels like it's a accurate description of what happens in the chapter. I agree that it's a little weird Sniper is so okay with the whole doll thing, except I also think he was literally bred to kind of be that person. I do think we get a sort of a hint at where this is going, which is that Jed, or possibly Jehovah... I no longer know the appropriate term to reference Jed Mason.
You know, like,
he has so many names.
You don't know what the appropriate term to call this character who is called by a bajillion names by other people is.
Yeah, what's the one that's relevant to us as a reader that I'll always be clearly referring to the right thing?
That's a great question.
There's no one else named Jehovah, but there's also no one else named Jed, and no one else is named J-E-D-D.
And no one else named J-E-D-D.
Jack Mohan is alone, Zhao Ha Wang is alone.
Tycoon.
Mm-hmm. Also.
Maybe I'll try defaulting to Jehovah for a while, because Jed, every time I say it now, I feel like I should have said J-E-D-D, because I can't pronounce the capitals.
Ah.
Unfortunately.
You could say the full name every time.
Jehovah Epicurus. But
that takes... No, thank you.
Jehovah Epicurus Donatien Dawei Mason.
Mason.
So, Jehovah, main character Mason.
Not it's to be clear, confused with our other main character, point. Also Mason.
Yeah, this book is very Arrested Development like that. I think it's clear at this point he's going
very history like that.
Try to shut down the hive system, which I can't even tell you is a bad plan. Getting rid of hives might just be a good idea that everyone should be on board with at this point. And the next chapter, which...
Why do you think getting rid of the hives is a good idea?
Just seems like it might be a good idea. You know, if we could all be part of one group instead of everyone having a bunch of outgroups, maybe that's for the best. Like, the Utopians whole monopoly on the concept of science. Who let that happen?
So what do you mean if... Okay, let's say we make it one hive for this purpose. you have to be members of the same governing body. There's one law to govern everybody. Do you have the choice? What if you don't like that? What if something about that system bugs you?
What if the hive system not even bugs something, you?
In theory, you can go to a different hive.
No, the hive system is the thing that bugs me. That's the problem. What am I to do?
You go to a reservation.
Oh, is that how those work?
Which we don't know much about. We don't really know much about reservations, but we know that people can go to them if they don't like the hives.
You know there's one in Pennsylvania.
We also know there's one in Tibet.
Interesting.
And that there are religious groups that have reservations as well.
Perhaps reservations would solve my problems with this. But frankly, based purely on what I know so far, which is that Jehovah thinks it's a good idea, presumably to get rid of hives, and Sniper, super stable Sniper, thinks maybe it's a bad idea. I know whose side I'm going to pick here in the absence of additional evidence.
One last thing before we move on to the next chapter. Mm-hmm. We also get a fair deal about Julia, because Julia is talking to Sniper.
Mm-hmm. Oh god, we do. We shouldn't have done three chapters. This is too much to get through.
I have opinions. Anyway.
Go on.
Julia, who is referred to as my owner by Sniper, because mm-hmm. that's A, plausible deniability, and B, I don't know, kinky shit.
No, that makes sense. He was given to her, like, very literally. I think he's just correct on that one.
Has a big back and forth with Dominic about, like, specifications to make sure. Julia's apparently a big Sniper fan, has posters, in particular one poster of Sniper as a puppet with, like, painted-on joints. By the way, you can actually buy, like, sleeves for painted-on joints if you want to dress up like a doll. They have them at Halloween stores, and it's September, so go out and buy some if you feel like doing your Sniper cosplay. There are a couple of bits about the most obvious here, I think, is Julia talking about how every day and her efforts and work are involved in this, like, power struggle and game, and it takes all of her effort to make sure that everyone around her is loyal to her and not being put in the other side's camp. And the only way to do that is to make sure that the only way to deny the enemy the opportunity is to make sure that someone is loyal to you instead, which means playing them and manipulating them. And it's tiring. And also they can kind of see what makes everyone tick, seemingly, like having X-ray vision and seeing the everything about a person. And it's hard not being able to get what you want in that circumstance, because you have to care so much about the big power game. And this thing with Sniper, who cannot move and cannot talk back and cannot do anything, is a release for them. And that, there's a lot going on there. I don't know that I can unpack it all. But in the realm of interesting philosophical questions, yes, does the way that someone have sex or other intimate relationships say something important about the way that they are in the more public-facing world? Something foundational about their nature, something about the way that they will respond to things, something about the way that they think about situations.
Does it say something important?
Yes.
Sorry, I'm leaning away from the mic again because I haven't recorded a podcast episode. No, does it say something important? I don't see why it would any more than any other sort of random factoid would. So to some extent, yes, but not to any, like, exceptional one, right?
Okay. Walwer, what's your opinion?
You know, does the way someone plays golf say something about the public-facing world?
I think it's less true for sex than it is true for their intimate relationships.
Hmm. Okay, can you unpack that?
Sure. So, in the intimate relationships, people often let their guard down, they reveal more of themselves, and they act a lot more in ways that they think will please other people directly, and they ask a lot more of what they think will please them directly, instead of, you know, trying to proceed through socially legible ways. Whereas in specifically sex, you don't interact sexually with most of the population, especially not in the ways that you do when you particularly like have intercourse. So I think it's just like less relevant, right?
Hmm. So, do you think this book agrees?
We said different things.
Yes. So, Liam's position is that no more so than other things, for example, the way someone plays golf, and you said maybe a little bit, but you would learn more from the way that they treat people that they're in intimate relationships with more than you would learn from the way that they do sex.
Yeah, and specifically...
Do you think this...
Like, this scene, we don't learn... Like, in some sense, you can talk about the way the sniper is interacting here as the way sniper has sex. But, like, this is more than
sex. I think that's
sex.
A bad read of what's happening. He's been paralyzed.
Yes.
And much like I wouldn't count the golf score of someone who I've paralyzed, I shouldn't count, if you will, the sex score of while he's being raped.
Yes. Although it is notable in terms of how he conducts intimate relationships, he tells us it's not rape. You know, he tells us that this is so incredibly wonderful that he's addicted to the situation now.
Well, but he already was. This is already the thing he has been trying to live out for years. Dominic just happened upon exactly his hobby.
Yes. No, that's right.
Julia happened on it. But my question you say that Sniper has been trying to have this for years. We do get a little bit about Sniper's previous sex scenes and, like, having sold themselves to fans for a night and being trying to be as pliable and unresponsive and as much like a doll as possible, and the fact that they are capable of movement, or even when they're restrained, reminded that they could theoretically move and are, like, powerful and have agency, is a problem that kind of kills the mood for all involved. And this, in a sequence where movement is completely impossible, and it wasn't Sniper's choice, Sniper didn't choose to be paralyzed, it works differently. In the same way, Sniper talks about, you know, wishing that someone would take away the duty that is theirs, you can't choose to give that up if you're talking about the most extreme version of the desire, the fantasy. But if Liam is saying this is what they've been going for years in a large portion of their life, does that suggest that we understand Sniper better because we know what they want sexually?
I think this is what Sniper wants in a much broader sense than sexually.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at. Sniper wants to, like, behave a way.
I think being a doll is Sniper's fundamental sort of calling, in a way that cannot be properly hemmed in by just saying it's a sexual thing for him. Like, it clearly also is, but I think his entire life is also built around this.
Mm-hmm.
This is a deeply important piece of what makes Sniper Sniper, is his attempts to be a thing instead of a person.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Most of what we relatedly get is not necessarily sexual, right? We mostly get, like, the comfort that Julia feels around Sniper, the wondrous, like, Sniper couldn't react to various things. The Sniper did not want to break by trying to interact with Julia, even though, like, Sniper also felt comfortable.
And this is because Sniper's not a person. He is a doll.
Aside from that part, which I cannot comment on because, you know, I know more things about the series than Liam does, I'm pretty much in complete agreement about this is the fundamental thing about Sniper, and that's their calling, as it were, and it happens that their sex life is in accord with the rest of the thing that they are called to be and called to do. So what about all the people at Madame's?
I don't understand your question. What about them?
Well, if my question is, is there something fundamental that you can learn about someone from the way that they have sex? Does Madame's place of gendered sex and philosophical discussion and all of the most important people in the world are in a room, all with the same kinds of interests. And I think it's either this chapter or the next where
I've got to stop you because you're being very silly with this question. Absolutely, yes, for the people at Madame's, because of the philosophy. You can learn a lot about someone from their philosophy. The sex isn't the part that makes that true. You seem fixated on it, and I don't know why. Like, in both of these cases, it's the other stuff that lets us learn so much about these people.
So why is Madame's important as opposed to a philosophy club?
I think a philosophy club would also be good. I think you could also learn a lot about people at a philosophy club.
Sure, but a philosophy club isn't running the world in this supposed scenario.
Yeah, but I don't know what connection you're trying to draw here. A philosophy club isn't running the world, but it's not the fact that you learn a lot about people doing philosophy that is... Or is your claim here that you think that that's how Madame is running the world? Is not by having her connections and doing her gendered scheming? Because as it's described in this chapter, it's like a game that everyone has to pretend they can't play. Are you saying Madame is running the world by learning about people more effectively by throwing the sex stuff in?
I'm suggesting that Madame is running a place that is, you know, sex, philosophy, theology, LARPing in the 18th century, all mixed together.
Yeah.
And we can learn something about the people who go to Madame's and their relationship to the world by the fact that they go to Madame's and that they are having the kind of sex that they are having, in theory, with A, gender, B, the LARPing thing, C, philosophy that they are doing while they are having sex. I mean, this is philosophy in the bedroom, as it were. And
much
I'm suggesting
like in the book,
that this book...
The sex is the least relevant part of that for the things we're talking about. We learn about Sniper here from his monologue and from what he's telling us about him. I don't know why you think that's so relevant to what we learn about people. We learn about them from all the other incredibly personal things that are going on. You know, the philosophy that someone holds can tell you a lot about them. The way they react to being kidnapped can tell you a lot about them. The fact that Sniper has a notch carved into his tooth because he may one day wake up and not be himself but be a doll instead, that tells me a lot about Sniper. Not really the sex part.
Okay, the sex does tell us a little bit, right? Because it continues the theme. Sniper describes himself as addicted to this.
But what he's addicted to is finally fulfilling his sort of this thing he's been trying to fulfill for years, which is to be the Sniper doll.
The way he describes being a doll is specifically in the realm of flings with fans, right? Herbert doesn't say, I wanted to be a doll, so I flew someone through a tea party for me where I was a doll in it. Well, I wanted to be a doll, so someone cuddled me for a night. Sniper says, I wanted to be a doll, but couldn't, because I kiss back.
Yeah. What I'm trying to use, like, Socratic things and not describe my actual point. But my actual point is somewhat closer to Liam's, that, in at least describing Sniper, that I don't think you can separate someone's sexuality from the way that they are in all of the other respects, especially in intimate relationships, where the philosophy, the way that they treat people, the things that interest them, they're all kind of jumbled together in the same, like, private realm. But there's a very interesting question that comes from that conclusion, which is that if there's something fundamentally important about the way that have sex and relevant to either their personality or the way that they view the world or all of these other things, that means that you can regulate the way that people are by regulating their sexuality.
No.
Which is no. I don't think so.
Right? Because the thing that's changed about Sniper over the course of this chapter wasn't anything core about them. It was something that they saw and able to engage in something that was core about themselves. So this wouldn't support it, right?
Sorry, could you explain that again?
So for one thing, Sniper didn't like... Sniper wasn't made into a person who wanted to become a doll. Sniper was already a person who wanted to be a doll. And then got a chance to become a doll. And then also, as Liam was saying, there's a jumble of everything else about them, which is not causally connected. I don't think you should view it as a causal connection between their sexuality and everything else. It's just that they are the way they are, and the way everything else about them is affects the way their sexuality is.
Okay. So, the idea being that therefore no imposition of, like, you know, the most bog-standard example is homosexuality. If people can't have sex with people of the same sex, then we're going to prevent some kind of nebulous degeneracy in our society. And
well,
you don't think that that's...
Let's think real hard about cutting this next sentence when we release the podcast. For some definitions of degeneracy, I think that's just obviously literally true.
If you define degeneracy to include gay sex, then yes, we're doing
yeah. Yeah,
gay
like,
sex.
Then by stopping them from doing it, guess what? You did prevent that. So I'm not... Yeah, like there, you can stop some things from happening by controlling the way people have sex, but those things are all sex things,
and not anything else. So, one of the most influential philosophers of the 20th century is a man by the name of Michel Foucault, who is a French guy who wrote a lot about systems of penal justice, executions, the prison system. He wrote a lot about the Panopticon.
I'm going to learn about how sex is a prison.
For anyone who's not familiar with Michel Foucault, a lot of people's joke read of Discipline and Punish is that this thing is like a prison. Everything is like prisons. Schools are prisons. Factories are prisons, etc. Get more material. It's a highly influential book. It has more to say, but there's a lot of things are like prisons in it. He also, wrote a multi-volume History of Human Sexuality, which is a philosophical exploration of the concepts of how society regulates sexuality in an attempt to control people, and B, was an exceptionally kinky homosexual man living in France in the 1970s and 80s, and you can argue that all of these things are interconnected in some important way, if you're French, at least. But what I'm trying to gesture at is that are some of these ideas that Foucault is talking about where society thinks by regulating sexuality it can control people. Is that relevant to the way that Madame's is presented or that Sniper's sexuality is presented?
I actually haven't read Foucault, so I don't know. I feel like I'd have to read Foucault in order to understand that. It's another philosopher to add to our list, I guess.
I have a passing familiarity with Foucault. I don't think I've ever actually sat down and read any of his work, but I have encountered his ideas doing ethics stuff. Probably not enough of it to really answer your question. I know he's big on power structures.
Yes.
So there's an obvious thing to get into here with how what Sniper fundamentally wants is to lose power.
Yes.
And weirdly, that's also what Julia wants in this exchange, is that she wants to give up her power for a day, but by taking power over a smaller set of things, I guess. But that's the best I could do for you. I think that throughout this whole chunk, you are immensely broadly sort of painting with sexual lines a bunch of things that don't need to be. And I understand where it's coming from in the context of the chapter, but I think most of what we learn about Sniper, most of what we learn about Julia, comes from the rest of the context, just like I think most of what you would learn about someone at, say, the philosophy brothel comes from the philosophy side and not the rest, even though the rest clearly does exist.
Well, I don't think it's that... I don't think there's, like, a sex bit. If you think you were going to categorize the chapter into sex bits and not sex bits, everything that important that we learn happens in the sex bits.
Don't think that's true. He talks about his family. He talks about his responsibilities. We hear him discussing whether or not he thinks he is a doll before he knows that's a thing that can happen to people. That's incredibly important characterization, and it happens pre-sex bit.
Like, a lot of it happens in the sex bit. And even, like, before we see Julia, there's a sex bit, right? The entire bit about Mycroft, if we were to start talking about what is it an art sex, is a sex bit, right? He talks about lovingly tracing the scars on Mycroft's body. He talks about...
In a way that asks you to make your own. Like,
yes.
That's a very, like, intimate physical thing, even though we are told that they have never had sex.
Because of...
And also that if they did have sex, Saladin would have killed them.
Yeah, because right, Saladin kills everyone who does. Yeah.
Yeah.
Saladin's getting away with a lot of murders. What is Papadelius doing? he was good at his job.
Apparently all these people are like people who... I cannot imagine the cousins let the services be prostitutes. Like in any world. So this must all be illegal, right?
Mycroft, break the law. But he's good now.
I don't think he's good now. Let's slow down with that.
But there's all these bits even before Julia that are sex bits. And even bits like during the thing we wouldn't not necessarily sex bits, like we describe a lot of what he's talking about as him wanting to be a doll. But it is a general feeling of wanting to be a doll, but he always talks about it in a sexual way.
At least a charged way.
I didn't find that to be as true as you're making it sound.
When he talks about why he can't be a doll, it's all about his flings, right? If it experiences having sex with other people who wants them to be dolls. But he couldn't do it.
Anyway, we need to talk about the last chapter, and we need to do it a very abridged telling of the last chapter. The good news is this was very political, and I don't have a lot of interesting world-building comments on it. We know some people are involved in the OS thing. We find out OS is a assassin program, so I'm pretty sure Thisbe has been one. Thisbe is apparently terrifying. We know Occam isn't OS, which threw me for a bit of a loop, because I had been assuming he was the whole book up until now. What with being named Occam Sunir, it just felt obvious.
It is said that
what Occam
OS is here. That's when Occam's OS.
Yeah, Occam's OS. The chapter
like,
says Occam's
OS. When they
OS.
Say OS is here, the guy who's there is Occam.
Yeah.
That's true. Maybe I've got my notes backwards on this. I know the identity of OS was very confusing to me between these two chapters.
Yes. I hope I clarified that earlier.
Yeah, yeah. Literally what I wrote was, wait, Occam isn't OS? Who's OS?
So it's interesting to note that the chapter we just spent a lot of time talking about just doesn't appear in whatever is published. So they go directly from prayer to God.
And it's the end. It is the entirety, but only the sniper stuff that is the restricted section that everyone thought they needed to restrict. Which, again, frankly, not that much worse than the content of the last book. I think they were overreacting, restricting this and none of the earlier stuff about Julia, you know, just left and right disrespecting her position.
Mm. It is also straight up saying, I'm going to kill this motherfucker.
Yeah.
Yeah, but Mycroft made plans to kill people in the last book. That was fine.
He didn't say, I'm going to do this. That's my plan. He was like, I planned to do this, and then I tried to do the thing. Or I told somebody else to do this, and then they tried to do the thing. Or they didn't.
Yeah, they specifically didn't. Have... Oh, I forgot that Saladin is still just wandering around with Bridger. Boy, I wonder if Saladin's going to be okay.
An Apollo Mojave coat.
Yeah.
Which is extra special.
Ooh. That's, he's in some peril. I had lost.
And they're going
track
after Dominic, who I guess has time between running his traps to like kidnap Sniper. It's anyway. We're talking about the next chapter.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The next chapter begins. We're dealing with Ganymede and Ondo and Casimir Perry.
The new character, secret best character.
Yeah, he seems a little annoying. Actually, I don't love Casimir.
People actually also find him annoying. He apparently, everyone calls him second best, second choice, in the previous book.
The outsider.
Mm-hmm, the outsider.
I get where everyone was coming from now. He feels whiny, and he doesn't do a good job keeping secrets. I don't know. I'm not very sold on this guy. I will not feel bad if he ends up getting murdered by someone.
Mm-hmm.
It's also notable, so what actually happens in this chapter is the head of the Europeans, the Mitsubishi, and most importantly the humanists, summon Occam in his role as OS, which is apparently the head of the assassination group, which we're going to call OS from now on, just because Sunir Weeks Booth Bosch assassination conspiracy is too long, asking him what's going on with the investigation and what's up, and getting an update, including finding out that Sniper is apparently missing. I wonder what's going on with Sniper. And then talking about the investigation, Martin talking about J.E.D.D. Mason as a person, whether he can be trusted with this information or not, before moving on to whether another hit should be called. Perry suggests that they should call a hit to stop the investigations into the Cousins Feedback Bureau for some reason that we don't actually know. And then there's an intense argument over, you know, who gets to call hits and who gets to use them and under what circumstances, as well as some finger pointing about who caused this problem in the first place and whether OS is at risk of exposure. Eventually, Occam leaves, and the rest of the three people basically go on to talk about all of the stuff that they care about with Madame's.
And then an orgy breaks out.
And only one person's watching. Two people are having sex. Ando starts.
That's three people. That's an orgy.
Okay, but one of them's only watching.
I don't think I don't think that's where you draw the line.
What can you learn about someone by where they draw the line on what is not an orgy?
I've said this before. It's when you put out a cheese plate.
In any cheese plate, in any context?
No, specifically in this context. But like, you know, when you're serving appetizers, that's when it became an orgy.
The appetizer in this case is Ganymede de la Trevoix.
Okay, I agree that if you're serving appetizers, it's generally an orgy. But like, you're not saying that's the only indication, right? This is a sufficient condition.
It's sufficient, not necessary?
Yeah.
No, I'm saying this is where you draw the line.
But
so,
like, if there's
in
like
this case,
20 people
right,
all
three
together.
Three people, that's enough people.
Mm-hmm.
Right, but no appetizers. So this is just uncomfortable. If it was three people and like, I don't know, pigs in a blanket and maybe some nice cheeses or some nuts.
Don't
doing
say
like
pigs
a little nice charcuterie board.
Context.
Oops, all of a sudden, no longer just uncomfortable, now it's both uncomfortable and an orgy.
If there are, like, 10 people, and there are no appetizers, orgy, not orgy?
Was a meal served?
No.
No. Just a mistake.
So just, you can have an arbitrary number of people having sex together.
I think we're being trolled.
And it's not an orgy.
It needs to be more than two, because otherwise...
Let
right.
n,
otherwise,
if n is,
you're just reproducing.
Let n be greater than 2. If n people, and n be a natural number, and
yeah.
If n people are having sex together, and there's not an appetizer plate, and there's no mm-hmm. meal, then it's not an orgy.
I'm willing to make that stand, yes.
Why?
Because you need a line somewhere.
Why would you make it there?
Why is the line
I don't know
the
what
food
to tell you.
And not
that's
the sex.
Just how it works.
Why is the line for an orgy a sexual act, like the one of the central examples of a sexual act, not about
yeah.
sex?
Because you can have
it's about
people
philosophy.
Having sex that isn't an orgy, so that's a bad differentiator, right?
But it's a kind of sex, right?
I disagree.
An orgy is a kind of
my
way of having sex.
And I have to admit to the audience that I'm not an expert on this subject, but my understanding is... One could have more than one flavor of sex, if you will, at an orgy. That's
yes.
the whole thing they do.
I don't know.
So that's
yes.
actually, that's key to the fundamental sort of supposition here, right? Is that as long as you have a sufficient number of people, you can have an arbitrary number of types of sex happening. The
okay,
key
okay,
distinction is, was there a cheese plate?
Oh my God.
So here's my question. Let's say there's a bunch of rooms yeah. where a bunch of pairs of people are having sex.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all like, the rooms are like arranged in a circle, and at the center of the circle is a separate room that has a cheese plate on it, so people can come out and get cheese, eat it, and then go back.
I'm fine.
Is that an orgy?
I'm comfortable with a serving room being used. Yeah. Yeah, I'm still on board.
So, like, all swingers.
It's clearly part of the same event.
So, like, all swingers things are orgies.
Is that what a swingers thing is like?
There's like
I'm unfamiliar, but potentially.
I don't think it's all in one place, but, like, you.
Okay.
If you need to go to a separate. If you need to leave the building or go to a clearly sort of delineated separate section of the building. So, let's say you're in an office.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not suggesting an office, just you have really clear barriers between different organizations, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if I need to leave my office and go into a separate organization, a floor down,
mm-hmm.
to visit the kitchen, no. Then that's not really food served, right? But if the food is present in the event, in the same situation that the event is being held, you know, whether it be served out of a side room or put out as perhaps some sort of buffet... then yeah, I think it counts.
Anyway, we also find out that Casimir Perry is super duper excited about being led into Madame's inner sanctum.
Yeah.
It's apparently so important to him that he's A, been working towards this for years in some important respect, and also it's like the last thing he says in this chapter is about how relieved and excited he is to finally have gotten
mm-hmm.
and being, like, done with the climb to get there.
This is for sure going to go badly for him.
Why do you think that?
Because it's the start of a book, and a character is excited about how they finally achieved some career goal. And I've read books
is
before.
Is it the start of a book?
So I will be very surprised if Casimir Perry gets everything he wants. And frankly, I don't really care for Casimir, so I'll be a little bit disappointed, too.
All right. So maybe we should talk a bit about Casimir Perry as a character. Why don't you like the man? You say he's whiny.
He's whiny. Also, apparently he's just letting people in on this secret conspiracy as is, like, personally convenient to him. And it's not even his conspiracy, right? So the way he's acting with Ganymede's secret, I don't appreciate it. I've said this before with the Mycroft thing. People should be better at keeping secrets than this. If you're let into a murder cult... And you're building towards it. Like, you weren't surprised by the murder element, right? You petitioned to enter the murder cult. And the first thing you do is bring 50 random people who work for you in? Fuck off.
But
that's
it's
a bad
more
plan.
Effective, Liam.
It's not more effective. You're gonna get outed as being part of a murder cult. I don't trust 5 people I work with, let alone 50 or more.
Like, this should be noted. These are, like, Woody's...
Parliamentary members.
Yeah, these are parliamentary members. In particular, these are coalition members. So what he's done is he's tried to weld a parliamentary coalition together with the fact that he is their doorway into the murder cult.
Mm-hmm.
So,
which...
Here's a...
Okay.
Sorry.
I was going to talk about how EU works. If your thing is going to be
how
shorter than that, go ahead.
My thing's not going to be short. I'm very sorry. You really need to figure out who you're talking to.
is it going to be more relevant than how the EU works?
In 1944,
oh, wow.
C.S. Lewis gave a talk at King's College in which he talks about one of the central moral issues of young people's lives. This is, you know, a graduation speech kind of thing. Is this issue of the inner ring.
Oh.
Where people are thinking that the important thing in life is to get inside. That there's a group that if they just enter, it will mean that they're important, that they've made it, that they can really make a difference, that they have all the right friends, all the right connections, that they will be the best if only they can get inside this selective group. Lewis's point in this talk is that this is one of the central moral eroding forces. Because A, they aren't actually that important, and B, people will destroy themselves and corrupt their morality trying to get in, whether that be a financial elite or a particular group or like a club or any of those things. And the interesting thing here is that A, Perry is using this concept aggressively to bring people into the conspiracy and say, hey, now you're on my side, you're part of the coalition. But also it's like apparently one of Perry's central motivating factors, because Madame's functions this way too.
But like,
especially with like having an inner sanctum that is like the most selective thing in the universe, and if you are there, it means you're basically a god among men. And he's so incredibly excited about getting there, he's apparently unconcerned with everything else once he finds out that he's finally being let in. And Madame's itself is also more exclusive than
C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis also contends that the inner ring doesn't matter because it literally cannot do the things it says it does, and that there's actually better groups around. This is simply not true in this world, right?
That's exactly what I was going to say. Yeah. Casimir is correct. This is the inner ring, and he is a god amongst men when he gets into it, right? He's not wrong about what he should be doing here. I just don't care for him.
So, if he's doing all of these things that push him into that position, and you think he's right to do so, why do you say that that he's doing it all wrong?
Because he's also doing other things that are shitty and bad.
Okay.
Like, his goals are clearly correct.
Well, I don't know if his goals are correct.
There literally is a circle.
But like,
if he wants power, he's doing the right thing. He's found the people. He's maneuvered his way in. He's made the political gains. I don't think he's really going to be a part of the circle, if you will. I think they're going to let him into I don't know how to describe it. I don't think anyone who is there is going to take him very seriously based on the conversation that they had about letting him in.
Okay.
He found the circle. He found the people he needed. He's right. He's making all the right plays to get political power. He's just also making a series of other dumb plays that he shouldn't be doing.
So here comes the next part of what I was going to say, and possibly I will ever let Wawa talk.
Let me tell you, the EU is... We're going to get to it. Go on.
His coalition... This is the reason why everyone's being critical of it, is his coalition is unstable compared to, say, Ondo's directors mostly, though, except for the Greenpeace director, and they're considered stable and going to be reliable, as opposed to Perry's hold on power, which is tenuous at best. He only got this job because he, according to, I think it's either Ondo or Ganymede who claims, I think it's Ganymede who claims, that the only reason Perry has power at all is because Perry arranged for this scandal that kept Spain from being prime minister again. And his connection to power is so incredibly tenuous that Ganymede could destroy him if he basically wanted to. Perry's holding on to what he's got by his fingernails and slipping. And the reason he's doing all this is to try and maintain that hold on power as desperately as he can by bringing more people in on this thing to create a coalition that will continue to support him. And that's different from, say, Spain or even Ganymede, who are like, yeah, I'm nobility. I don't have to worry about holding onto that thing because people will join up around me and understand that I'm top dog regardless.
I don't
have to work for it.
True for either of them.
As much. You don't.
Like,
it talks a lot about how Kit Perry is working relentlessly. How he doesn't sleep because he's doing all this.
Well, it's not because... the thing I'm attracted to is that it's because of the nobility. Ganymede is popular, is specifically popular, not because he's noble, and that he hates that. He hates that so much. It makes him hate everything or every single person other than his sister. He's just, like, looks pretty, and is, like, popular, and so he gets lots of votes. And, like, Sniper's votes, so he gets lots of votes.
And Sniper's votes, and that's very true. Is it just because he's pretty? We do hear a lot about how pretty Ganymede is.
Yeah, I think his prettiness has more to do... I think his prettiness has more to do with it than his nobility.
Huh. I really didn't see it that way. Okay.
Because he's lots of separate parts of Macrova's like, and actually, it doesn't really matter that he's noble, and he can't really take back because he's noble, and etc., etc. Like...
Okay.
Like... It's fancy. He's looked at well because he calls himself a duke as part of his like thing, but I bet if he wasn't actually a duke, it wouldn't really matter.
Okay, but the fact that Spain is the king of Spain is like incredibly important,
yeah.
And that's his actual rival.
Yeah, and he hates Spain the most because of that.
I'm sorry, Perry's actual rival in this dynamic is everybody expects Spain, and it's Perry, and Perry can't hold on to power the way Spain would.
Yeah.
As a result.
And the closest thing to a noble is Spain, and Spain also just gets votes. People like Spain.
It's very possible that the closest thing to a noble is Denayer the brother, who very well may literally have 100% noble genes.
I don't think that's the way... Spain is Spain. Spain is literally a monarch. Like, Spain is descended from a monarch.
Yeah. Is that the House of Bourbon?
Yeah, House of Bourbon.
Okay.
Spain is literally this... Right.
But if we conceive of nobility as sort of a heritable thing,
Bourbon Anjou, yeah,
then it's very possible that Danae, with her 100% written genome, just has more nobility genes than any living monarch who is descended from monarchs could possibly have, what with inevitable dilution and all.
I don't think that's what you.
So now it's a blood quanta question.
I don't think nobility is a matter of blood quanta. I don't think
historically nobility often has.
I don't think nobility did. I think, and specifically Spain, is not a matter of blood quanta, right? In the sense that Spain is a noble and it matters, because Spain is the king of Spain descended from other kings of Spain, irrelevant of other people who married into the family. It matters that Spain is the king of Spain because other kings of Spain have presided over the birth of the political system, have presided over the birth of democracy, have fought against fascists, etc., etc.
Looking at the clock on this episode, and knowing that you're now going to have to cut at least 18 minutes of what has, I think, mostly been good content, I'm just going to let you have that one. And,
didn't actually start talking about the books until we got, 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Okay, so what are the other big things we need to hit on from the politics chapter?
Occam acts like a soldier.
Yes.
Occam clicks his heels.
Yeah.
Occam
yeah.
clicks his heels like a German.
He must have got it from a movie. Yeah. We get that Jed is superior in the bash to who was talking at the time? Is it the Emperor?
Ganymede.
Or is it Ondo? There's a big back and forth about whether or not someone can tell Jed to just go be better.
Yeah.
And we get that Jed is kind of above them.
That's Ganymede.
Ganymede.
Ganymede is Duke, but Jed is Prince.
Yes.
Which also raises a question of, why is JDDD Mason a prince?
What's his mother again?
Because they're not saying Porphyrogene, right?
Yeah, no, they're saying
just
Prince.
Because, yeah.
In the brothel. That he's of the rank prince. What is the Madame?
I guess Madame should be royalty then, right?
Like, yeah.
Or
the Emperor.
I guess
perhaps.
We don't. Or yeah, but the Emperor is not really he's not a king. They would say like Porphyrogene, right?
But is the Emperor a king in the brothel ranking?
He perhaps is. Okay, that might be it.
That's
okay.
What I mean.
Okay.
In any case, that happens. We get that Jed Mason is not going to be willing to compromise on his ethics. Way to go, Jed. Compromises for losers.
Yeah, because of this weird argument about infinities and math, and how calculus doesn't work if you have infinities on both sides, which I don't know that I buy.
What? Oh. The infinities on both sides. Okay. So, I guess I have two ending spiel rants in me. The first is about infinity, the second one is about EU.
Go for the infinity one. You already let our guest get rid of the EU thing. I'm sorry. You should have known who you were talking to.
The EU thing is actually relevant because it's... Okay. Infinity. I can cover it quickly. Infinity is a... a lot of the problems that come... When you try to introduce infinity into mathematics, a lot of problems come up. And it turns out a lot of these problems are because we don't really have, in our heads, a rigorous notion of what infinity means. And if we select any one of the notions we have in our heads, we end up with very different things. So one kind of infinity one could talk about is something called cardinal infinity, and that is talks about the number talks about a way of counting. A particular way of counting counts with the number of things in a set. And when you talk about the number of things in a set, you can make them correspond to numbers, and you do this in the standard way with small numbers, like 7 or 6 or 7 billion. But when you get to large numbers, things start getting wonky. And in particular, you can show that if you take all the odd numbers and all the even numbers together, there's infinite amount of odd numbers, an infinite amount of even numbers. It turns out they're the same number of even numbers as the odd numbers. Mm-hmm. And moreover, when you take those and unify them in the set of all numbers, all integers, that's the same number. The same number of integers as the odd numbers as the even numbers. And you can formalize this into a kind of addition. And you can actually say that this set of infinity plus this other infinity is the same infinity. This sort of behavior tends to be very common when you talk about infinite arithmetic.
Huh. So you're telling me if I take the infinity of all of the odd numbers and all of the even numbers and I put them together, I get not the infinity that is all, I'm going to say numbers and I mean like whole numbers. Mm-hmm.
You do get that.
Okay.
Which is the same as the infinity as all the even numbers.
And all the odd numbers individually.
Yeah.
Separately from each other.
Yeah.
So that, is that just the countable and like countable infinites are equal is the idea?
That's exactly the sentiment here. Okay. That's the formalization of what we're talking about.
Okay. This is the part where I have to confess that my mathematics is not the best.
You know what? You got this far.
This is also the part.
And I'm not great at communicating, so.
I'm also just going to suggest that, like, I don't think that's how morality works.
Okay.
Like, I don't think the unions involved here are actually the moral calculus. I believe that Jed can believe that. I just don't necessarily think that means that Jed's correct.
Okay, that's fair. I'd screw with Jed as well.
So, on that subject, Wawer, what is your Discord username?
Wawer OS?
Yeah, what's the OS stand for?
It's a pun. It's actually a pun. It's not
okay. If it's a reference to your actual name, I won't dox you here.
No, it's my name is Wero. I tell my name to everyone constantly every week. It's a verb. It's a phonetic pun on that. Wero, Wero S, which means people just don't know. I have gotten so many nicknames. I like nicknames. Don't get me wrong. One of my gateway goals in life is to obtain as many nicknames as I can. But I just have gotten so many nicknames.
Jean Mohan, Jed, Mike.
But people just like don't know that it's not a very clear pun, and people don't know my name is a name that happens. It's not a very good pun, and so people just call me the first bit because my last name is just OS. People think that this is a reference to OS.
I thought it was a reference to operating systems, honestly.
Yeah, but I'm also on a Discord full of people who read this book and like it a lot.
Yeah.
That's
like,
true.
There are other people in this Discord with usernames like Canis Domini.
Yeah, right? I bet people think I'm just, like, really pro-OS. Huh.
Yeah, for sure. They'd have to.
But it's not. Interesting. On the subject of OS.
Actually, on the subject of Europe, about this book, we actually learn how the Europeans are governed in this chapter. They're governed exactly the way they're governed now. Which
is terrible!
It's so funny. It's so funny. Let me tell you how the EU works. Okay, so the first bit, the relevant bit that we learn about, is that relevant to how earlier Mara was talking about how vulnerable and tenuous Cosmo Perry talks about being. This is, like, literally true, it turns out, because the thing that's closest to a cabinet in the EU is called the Commission. And the Commission is notable in that it has a member from every single member country of the EU. So currently there are 27 members of the EU, so there are 27 members of the Commission. There are, to put it bluntly, more members of the EU in Terra Ignota than there are now. So they're like...
The Kurds, for one.
Kurds, that's Canada,
there might be more than a reference later, and we don't remember the order.
Yeah, there's like...
I remember Kurds is this chapter.
If they are Kurds, and if they're also kind of that, who knows what else is in there.
Yeah.
Oh, Philippines. So, of course, that's like literally like just widely separated parts of the globe. So, there probably need more members. So, there probably like 50 or more than 50 members of the commission at least who he has to like wrangle. Second,
yep.
The European Parliament is one of three legislative bodies of the EU. The European Parliament, the European Council, and the Council of Europe.
In my estimation,
those last two are different.
The most unrealistic thing in this entire series that includes flying cars and sex dolls and a literal child who brings things to life by touching them is the fact that the EU is the basis of world stability and is still together after 400 years.
No, I can imagine them being together. Like, the US is like this, too. When you look at things closely, it looks absolutely fucking bonkers. The EU is more bonkers.
Yeah, but someone thought about...
But, like, it's still... the US is still bonkers. But they must have changed things, right? Yeah, someone
thought about putting the US together instead of, like, hey, let's all be in the same region for exchanging steel and not have tariffs and have tariffs on everybody else. And then they turned that into a government.
That's what happened to us.
No, it's not. It's
close enough.
We had, like, ideological questions and disputes about the nature of a nation, not like, eh, let's all be part of a group.
Oh, that you one. Are projecting backwards. The U.S. did not consider us a nation for, like, at least 70 years. Not until, like, the 1860s, at least.
Oh, speaking of the concept of the motto of the United States, this is relevant to the previous chapter. Benjamin Franklin's original proposal for what the motto of the United States should be was death to tyrants is obedience to God. And we have someone talking about committing tyrannicide against someone who is God, which is a weird little tidbit.
So what I'm hearing is I should keep my ear out for kites and lightning.
You know there's lightning already! We just talked about the lightning! Oh, I also wanted to discuss this question. And I wanted to specifically ask Liam first. Liam, what does OS stand for?
Operating system.
In the book.
Oh, hang on, I think it told me.
A lot of things are OS, it turns out. If you're looking for a particular speech, there
Owen
is a speech
and Schwarzschild.
About, yes, it talks about, Sniper talks about Wilfred Owen, and I forget his first name, Schwarzschild. Wilfred
Carl
Owen
Schwarzschild.
Is a poet in, thank you, poet in World War I, who wrote exceptionally evocative and moving in like
yeah, the
a
book...
complete terror. Fashion.
I hate to break this to you, but you're actually just reciting the book this time. It told us all this.
But there are some interesting lines in that description. For example, the idea that Owen could have done good or bad things based on their poetic skill. One of the things that is mentioned is, you know, cause a rash of suicides. And it's notable that that's not like an unreasonable thing to be worried about, at least in the year 1918. Owen died a week before World War II ended. It's especially tragic. Or World War I ended, my apologies. But like there was in the previous century, there was a book that people were like, yo, everyone who reads this book kills themselves. We need to stop people from reading
Which
it.
Which book?
The Sorrows
of Young Werther. That. Yeah.
Yeah.
There was also a song
Were the rights committing suicide,
that they had to
yeah.
stop playing because people kept killing themselves when it came on the radio.
Oh, I didn't know that one.